And Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings, listeners, from your sartorially genial host, John Derbyshire, here once again with VDare.com's weekly news roundup. Tuesday this week was New Year's Day on the traditional Chinese lunar calendar. We are now in the Year of the Pig. See what I did there? I committed an act of cultural appropriation. Among those offended by my thoughtlessness is one Cassie Cho, who runs something called BuzzFeed World Instagram account. Don't ask me. Tweeted Miss Cho on Wednesday. Tweet. Friendly reminder that you don't get to celebrate Lunar New Year unless you're literally from a country that does. Or if you are invited by someone who is from a country that does. End tweet. I'm not sure that applies to me, unless Mrs. Derbyshire's greeting me on Monday morning with the words, "Clean up your study and help me set up the dining room. We have people coming." Counts as invitation. I celebrated anyway with a full house of family and friends. And my invitation to Cassie Cho would be, go boil your head, lady. President Trump dashed my hopes this week by giving a full-dress State of the Union speech to Congress and various other notables, Supreme Court justices, military chiefs, and worthy persons of one kind or another not on the public payroll. Those worthy persons are the ones we have come to refer to as Lenny Skutniks. Just 2 weeks ago on this podcast, I was crowing over the likelihood that, thanks to the government shutdown, we would be spared this horrible imperial spectacle, this Stalinesque extravaganza. No such luck. Same preposterous spectacle, same grandiose promises and pronouncements from the president. Same standing ovations from his party after every damn punctuation mark. Same sullen scowls from the other side at particularly contentious points. I deplore the whole thing. It's a disgrace to the very idea of Republican government. Our president is not a pharaoh. He's not the son of heaven, scattering blessings o'er a grateful land. He's not the general secretary of the Communist Party, shepherding us all forward into a radiant future. He is a functionary we've hired for a short period to head up one of the three branches of our federal government. I wish he would do some of that instead of reading gassy speeches that someone wrote for him. Concerning the Lenny Skutniks, I likewise long to hear that one of them has refused the invitation to participate in this totalitarian charade. Jean-Paul Sartre turned down the Nobel Prize for Literature. Gregory Perelman refused the Fields Medal prize money. Isn't there anyone who can decline an invitation to be applauded by a hall full of corrupt, stupid Congress puppets, half of them drunk? Let me hasten to add that I intend no disrespect to Lenny Skutniks. Certainly not to the actual, original Lenny Skutnik, who did a very brave and selfless thing. The same applies to others being applauded up there in the gallery on Tuesday night. Buzz Aldrin's name will be remembered long, long after the names of everyone else in that chamber along with my name and your name, have been lost in the rubble of history. And rightly so. I'm only regretting that they don't see what I believe I see. The utterly un-Republican, small r, the un-Republican nature of the spectacle as it has developed. I may even have an ally here in the original Lenny Skutnik. In an interview with Politico 3 years ago, just before Barack Obama's last State of the Union address, 66-year-old Lenny was asked if he still watches the event. Quote from Lenny, slightly edited. I watch the State of the Union to see who's going to be the guests. They get carried away with too many guests. Today they're talking about the Obama administration. They want to get some Muslims in there, a Syrian refugee. What's he trying to do? Piss everybody off? He's an activist president. He's nuts. End quote. Later in the interview, Lenny drops a hint that he will likely vote for Trump that November. I hope you did, Lenny. Enjoy your retirement. And this year's Lenny Skutniks did actually include one person whose feelings about the federal government's annual act of self-glorifying narcissism accord precisely with mine. This was, of course, 11-year-old Joshua Trump of Delaware, invited by the First Lady because he'd been bullied at school on account of his surname. Parked in the gallery there while the president droned on and the Congress lackeys cheered, young Joshua soon lost interest and fell asleep. Joshua is a true hero of the Republic. All patriotic citizens should follow his example. The most dismaying thing in Trump's actual speech was his vow massively to increase immigration into the USA. Actual quote. I want people to come into our country in the largest numbers ever, but they have to come in legally. End quote. That is a complete repudiation of numerous statements Trump made before, during, and in the months after the 2016 election campaign, when he committed himself to protect American workers by reducing legal immigration. Now he wants immigrants to come, quote, in the largest numbers ever. That's a 180-degree turn and a smack in the face to millions of citizens who took him at his earlier word. Most of the public talk about immigration is conducted at an infantile level. Moralized, emotionalized, romanticized. Evil, leering white men from the movie set of Deliverance resent polite, hard-working brown people from south of the border and lock up their children in cages. Now, you know the script. There are a few small clearings in the rainforest of moralistic gibberish, though, places where immigration issues, social, cultural, economic, patriotic, are weighed rationally among thoughtful people with honest disagreements. One position you encounter a lot if you frequent those clearings is legal immigration, good. Illegal immigration, bad. Now that's a reasonable position that can sincerely be held. It can also be insincerely held. For example, by business lobbies who want to replace free citizen software developers with cheaper indentured workers from India to reduce their labour costs. I say again, though, that the legal good, illegal bad position can be held for unselfish motives. People will even make an economic case for it. I don't myself find that case persuasive. But not everybody saying legal good, illegal bad, not everybody is a cynic on the make. Those business lobbies are mighty powerful, though, and they seem to have captured the Trump administration. The week before Trump's State of the Union address, his Department of Homeland Security issued revised guidelines for the issuance of H-1B visas. That's the visa for those indentured guest workers from India to replace middle-class American office workers. The new H-1B guidelines seem to have been written by the business lobbies and then just approval stamped by DHS. John Miano, who with co-author Michelle Malkin wrote the book on current legal immigration, John Miano posted a scathing review of the new guidelines. Sample quote from him. These regulations might best be called "The Swamp Has Taken Over the Trump Administration," end quote. John speculates on the political consequences. He tells us he's been getting calls from worker activists who supported Trump in 2016. They want to know about possible primary challengers for 2020. Of course, those activists don't have Trump's ear. The White House doesn't return their calls anymore. John Miano doesn't have Trump's ear either. Neither do Michelle Malkin or Ann Coulter. Neither do I. Neither do you. It's those business lobbies who have his ear. The question Trump should ponder is, how many general election votes do those business lobbies bring with them? If there is now any hope for a second Trump term, it surely lies in the Democratic Party committing collective suicide by embracing full utopian socialism. Some of them are doing exactly that. Last week, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts launched their Green New Deal program. And several Democratic presidential hopefuls have already declared their support for it. Here are some points from that program. Ban all fossil fuels, coal, oil, natural gas. Eliminate nuclear power. Every building in America, that's what they actually say, every building in America to be fitted with, quote, state-of-the-art energy efficiency. Replace air travel with high-speed rail. A job for everybody, guaranteed by the federal government. A guaranteed house for everybody. Free education for life. Guaranteed economic security for all who are, quote, unable or unwilling to work. Government provided, quote, healthy food, but not including meat, which will be banned. Yep, that's the dream of socialism. I wonder if Senator Markey and Representative what's her name realize how very old that dream is. The great Soviet dissident, mathematician Igor Shafarovich, in his book The Socialist Phenomenon, traced it all the way back to the slave rebellions of antiquity. The dream has been with us ever since. It leaked into Christianity as the doctrine of the second coming, when an era of peace, justice, and plenty will be established to last 1,000 years. From that, we get the adjectives millennialist and its Greek equivalent, kiliastic. This utopian dream is not particularly Christian, though, nor even exclusively Western. The leaders of peasant rebellions in ancient China often preached millennialist ideas. These ideas seem to be a universal feature of human thought everywhere, in all times and places. One of my favourites in this general line of thought is the early 19th century French philosopher Charles Fourier, who promised that in a future socialist utopia, the oceans will be turned into lemonade. He was in dead earnest. He even provided details of the necessary chemical transformation. Ah, the radiant future. A phrase, by the way, that was coined, or at any rate popularized, by Trotsky. It's all a lie, of course, whether it comes from Joachim of Flora, from Charles Fourier, from Trotsky, or from Ed Markey and Alexandria Thingamajig. The everlasting peace, justice and plenty have a way of ending up as slave labor camps, mass killings, starvation, and the crushing of independent thought. If you seek those oceans of lemonade, you end up at last with present-day Venezuela, if you're lucky. If you're unlucky, you end up with the Khmer Rouge. Perhaps that's the intention all along, at some unconscious level. Igor Shafarovich thought so. Quote from him: "The death of mankind is not only a conceivable result of the triumph of socialism, it constitutes the goal of socialism." Just to clarify here, I of course know that the House of Socialism has many mansions, and that millenarian socialism, like the programme laid out in this Green New Deal, is an extreme version. Not all socialists believe in lemonade oceans, or want to guarantee security to people who are unwilling to work. What you might call ordinary socialism, and what its proponents like to call democratic socialism, is comparatively sensible. I don't say you have to agree with it, but it's not crazy, like the programme of Senator Markey and the Puerto Rican gal. Nor is it new. Bismarck gave Germans some basic socialism in the 1880s. Government health insurance, old age and disability insurance. Nobody ever called Bismarck a left-wing firebrand. Likewise, Teddy Roosevelt, who ran on similar issues in 1912. And then there was Norman Thomas, the standard-bearer of American socialism through the second quarter of the 20th century. Thomas wasn't a lemonade oceans guy. He just wanted better living and working conditions for ordinary people. He ran for president 6 times on a socialist ticket. every presidential election from 1928 to 1948. Thomas never won the presidency, of course, but his tireless campaigning must have helped acceptance of New Deal socialist reforms. He boasted at the end of his life, he died in 1968, about a mile from where I am sitting. He boasted that all the social reforms he had campaigned for were now uncontroversial and accepted. That boast also illustrates the fact that socialism, democratic socialism that is a moving target. When Charles Dickens published his novel Hard Times in 1854, Macaulay sneered at its, quote, sullen socialism. In fact, there's no political program in Hard Times at all. The nearest thing to a modern socialist in the novel is Slackbridge, the bullying, bloviating union organiser who Dickens plainly disapproves of. Dickens was a moralist who wished people would be nicer to each other. If he had lived long enough to see Bismarck's reforms, he would probably have disapproved of them. To a wise man of the 1850s, however, even to a progressive like Macaulay, Dickens' sentimental sympathy for the working man smelled like socialism. So, yes, I'm well aware that socialism isn't all lemonade oceans. That's what's on offer from this current batch of radicals, though. The ones who stormed into Congress last month. Are there enough grown-ups left in the Democratic Party to fend them off? If I knew the answer to that question, I could predict the result of the 2020 election with fair confidence. February is, of course, Black History Month. So far, just 1 week in, the reminders are piling up. I have logged the following outrages that have Black Americans cowering in fear in their tar paper shacks. 1. Ralph Northam, the white Democratic governor of Virginia, appeared in his 1984 medical school yearbook, either in blackface or in a Klan robe and hood, or neither, depending on who you believe. His picture in the 1981 yearbook of the Virginia Military Institute shows him having the nickname Coon Man. Governor Northam has been swinging wildly between denial and apology, with apology, I think, predominating. 2. The movie actor Liam Neeson, who I remember as a fine, brooding Ethan Frome, explained to an interviewer how he'd worked up the anger for a film role that he's just recently performed. He had recalled his feelings from an incident 40 years ago, he said, when a lady close to him was raped by a black man. The enraged young Neeson had gone out, this is presumably in London, gone out looking for a random black man with the intent to kill him. Fortunately, he calmed down before committing any violence. He has spent the last few days apologising and protesting that he's not racist. 3. January 28th, in a New York Times op-ed, Daniel Pollack Pelsner, who teaches English at Liberal Arts Linfield College in Oregon, told us that Mary Poppins is problematic. I'm sure that's the right word, problematic. Because In the classic movie version, Mary deliberately blackens her face with soot. While in the original Mary Poppins books by Pamela Travers, 1930s to 1950s, characters use language about black people that we would consider offensive in 2019, although nobody would have thought so in 1940 or 1950. 4. Gucci has been marketing an $890 black knitted top, whose neck you can roll halfway up to your face, where there is an opening for your mouth, the opening featuring a red knitted surround that looks like big lips. This has caused outrage. Gucci has withdrawn the item and issued gushing apologies, affirming that, quote, if I can get through the quote without throwing up all over my microphone, quote, we are fully committed to increasing diversity throughout our organization and turning this incident into a powerful learning moment for the Gucci team and beyond. End quote. 5. Adidas brought out a new line of sneakers expressly in celebration of Black History Month. Unfortunately, the sneakers are totally white. Twitter storm! Adidas has now withdrawn the sneakers. I ended my last segment wondering if there are enough grown-ups in the Democratic Party to fend off the party's radicals. I'm going to end this one by wondering if there are enough grown-ups in the United States to avert our apparently remorseless slide down into babbling infantilism. And look at the implicit anti-whiteness on display in those stories. The merest, most trivial slight is taken to be outrageously offensive to the fragile sensibilities of blacks, even if it's from decades ago, while viciously anti-white comments go unremarked. They will, in fact, get you a job on the New York Times editorial board. I've been a fan of political science professor Eric Kaufman since reading his book, The Rise and Fall of Anglo-America, a dozen years ago. Now here was Professor Kaufman this week, writing in National Review. Headline: How Asymmetrical Multiculturalism Generates Populist Blowback. You can read the thing for yourself on the internet. And yes, Kaufman can fairly be categorised as alt-light. He stays well clear of live rails. He doesn't touch race realism, for example. Still, he has an interesting mind and a nice turn of phrase. Asymmetrical multiculturalism, for example. Quote, at multiculturalism's heart lies a contradiction. White majorities are compelled to be cosmopolitan, urged to supersede their ascribed identity. Minorities are enjoined to do the reverse. End quote. You nailed it, Prof. Sanctified minorities get a month of their own, cherishing their precious, nursed and petted identities. They shriek and swoon at the most trivial imagined slight, and everyone rushes to soothe their wounded feelings. The place of white people in this drama is to grovel, apologize, grovel, apologize, and plead pitifully, I'm not racist. The astonishing thing to me is that so many whites have put up with this silly nonsense for so long. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. As Radio Derb goes to tape here, the airwaves are full of news about a spat between Jeff Bezos, who needs no introduction, and a chap improbably named David Pecker, who somehow survived high school and who now runs American Media Inc., parent company of the National Enquirer sensationalist tabloid. The spat somehow involves photographs Mr. Bezos took of his private parts. Good taste forbids me digging any deeper into the story. I leave you with what seems to me the definitive comment on it from tweeter Jerry Dunleavy. Tweet: a story about a guy named Pecker getting exposed for trying to expose a dick pic belonging to a man who is world famous for his packages would be rejected by The Onion. Item. Before leaving this regrettable zone altogether, here is some emoji news. Emojis are those dinky little symbols that people include in their smartphone or IM messages to indicate pleasure, displeasure, doubt, and so on. For this year, the year 2019, 270 new emojis have been announced by whoever it is that announces new emojis. One of these new emojis is of a hand with thumb and index finger just an inch apart. The idea is to signify a small quantity of something, I suppose. But everyone is taking it to be an insult emoji, signifying that some guy has a tiny penis. Literary types will find themselves thinking of the writer F. Scott Fitzgerald, who once confessed to his friend Ernest Hemingway an agonized conviction that his penis was too small. Hemingway took a look and said he thought the item was all right. Then he advised Fitzgerald, for further reassurance, to go check out the classic male nude sculptures in the Louvre. This all took place in Paris. That's sound advice from Hemingway. I'm not totally familiar with the Louvre's inventory, but to any male listener afflicted with the same insecurity as F. Scott Fitzgerald, I recommend a careful scrutiny of the Farnese Hercules. Item. I have been a tireless reader of all kinds of matter since the Truman administration, so it's not often I come across a word I don't know. It happened the other day, though. I was reading the December issue of Literary Review, a magazine I have advertised before on this podcast. The precise thing I was reading was Donald Rayfield's review of a book about revolutionary postcards in Imperial Russia. Second paragraph, first sentence, quote: for much of the 19th century, the authorities systematically scrutinized correspondence. But by the 20th century, there were too many millions of letters to perlustrate everything, a practice that only again became feasible under Soviet rule. End quote. To what everything? perlustrate? I had to look it up. This reviewer, Donald Rayfield, is billed as Emeritus Professor of Russian at Queen Mary University of London. If Professor Rayfield is ever in New York, I will buy him dinner at a nice restaurant, in gratitude for his contribution to enlarging my vocabulary. Спасибо, профессор. Item. I don't think I made a very good job of answering the Proust questionnaire in my December diary. I didn't take it very seriously, I'm afraid, mainly because I have trouble taking Proust very seriously. My colleague, the audacious Epigon, over at the UNS Review, did a much more conscientious job of it. My answer to the question, how would you like to die, was at least perfectly honest, though. Instantaneously, was my reply. If you then asked me in what manner I should least like to die, I might give you different answers on different days of the week. But way up there among my answers would definitely be being eaten alive by pigs. That was the fate of a lady in Russia last week. We don't know the lady's name, only that she was a peasant, 56 years old, in the Malopurginsky district of Udmurtia. She went out to feed the pigs, suffered some kind of seizure or fit, fell into the pigsty, and the pigs ate her. And if it were my fate to be eaten alive by pigs, I'd wish for it not to happen in a place named Udmurtia, which sounds like it was made up by one of the grimmer kinds of fantasy novelists. Mervyn Peake, perhaps. The Malopurginsky district of Udmurtia. Is this actually the real world that I'm living in? Sometimes it's hard to be sure. Item. Another death to report, although this one, thank goodness, less grisly. Movie actor Albert Finney died on Thursday at the Royal Marsden Hospital in London. From a chest infection, say the reports. I assume that means pneumonia. Known to my mother's generation of nursing professionals as the old man's friend, because it saw you off without much pain. Finney was 82. I just got through praising Albert Finney, also in my December diary, for his role in the movie Under the Volcano. That movie was 1984, well along in Finney's career. To us 60s survivors, he will always be Tom Jones in the 1963 movie of that name. Then, down towards his later years, he was a fine Winston Churchill in The Gathering Storm. I'm not much of a movie person, and I don't hold actors in much regard as a rule. I'll make an exception for Albert Finney, though. The world is poorer for his passing. May he rest in peace, and condolences to his loved ones. That's it, ladies and gents. Thank you for listening, and welcome once again to the Year of the Pig. Just be careful if you're in charge of feeding any of those critters. You don't slip and fall. How about another novelty song to see us out? Once in a while, when the mood takes me and I'm going to some event where I have to look my best, once in a while I go in full dress uniform. Dark blue three-piece suit from a very respectable London tailor, with my grandfather's gold watch in a vest pocket, and the gold chain and fob that go with it. This is the song that goes through my head as I sail out thus, under full canvas. It's an old Cockney ballad from the music halls, and you need to know a couple of things. One, a feature of early 20th century street life was the scrap metal merchant, working the streets with his horse and cart, calling out, "Any old iron?" Two, tile is slang for hat. Okay, off we go. There will be more from Radio Derb next week. Here's Stanley Holloway.
Just a week or two ago, my poor old Uncle Bill went to kick the bucket and he left me in his will. The other day I popped around to see poor Auntie Jane. She said, "Your Uncle Bill has left to you a watch and chain." I put it on, right across my vest. Thought I looked a dandy as it dangled on my chest. Just to flash it off, I started walking round about. A lot of kiddies followed me and all began to shout, "Any old iron, any old iron, any old iron. You look neat, talk about a treat. You look a dapper from your napper to your feet. Dressed in style, a brand new tile and your father's old green tie on. But I wouldn't give you tuppence for your old watch, Jane. Old iron, old iron." Napper to your feet, dressed in style, a brand new tile, your father's old green tie on. But I wouldn't give you tuppence for your old watch chain, old iron, old iron.